This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We're part of Pacifica Stations, the Pacifica Radio Network. Pacifica, the word comes from pacifist, not just that they happen to be in the Pacific Ocean. Pacifist Station was born during the Vietnam crisis. WBAI was, and it was here as a protest against the war. So what you've been hearing on our station is people who are very clearly saying war is not the answer to having any solution to what's going on. And of course, the debate over Syria has been heartbreaking to so many people. People who felt their trusts in the current president feel that they've been betrayed in many ways. So we have this issue about aggression. And then we have this other issue about passivity. And then we have another issue called the pacifist. And I want to approach those all today. First, I want to talk about passive-aggressive and aggressive. Whenever you see anyone who is an acting out, this is unrelated to Syria right now. I'm taking you down a whole different path. Just as a beginning. When you see someone who is an aggressor, an aggressive person, a person who is right out there, a person who is always speaking the truth, they're loudmouths, they always say what they think, they offend people. Let's call those people aggressive people. They don't have to hit anybody, they don't have to beat anybody, they don't have to slap anybody, but they're aggressive. They're aggressive in the way they approach the world. They come after the world. I know one particular woman, her name is Barbara, who is part of a team of mental health workers, and Barbara prides herself on saying, I always tell the truth. I put myself out there all the time. So one would imagine, well, what a lucky person. They're expressing their anger all the time. Well, I'm not so sure it's lucky. I remember I used to be part of a group therapy a while back where it was a group of people got together, and there was a in this group therapy, one of the things that the therapist was working at was trying to get people to express their anger when they felt their anger. And people had difficulty with it because they would hide it behind different things. Except for this one person who was out there, and he was so loud, and he was angry, and he was easy to scream, and it was just very easy for him. And he said, this is therapy? He said, this is like being with my family. He grew up with a family of people who were always screaming at each other. Aggressive people tend to be out front. Now, that's the good news. The good news is they're out front and they're expressing their anger directly. That's nice, you know, when they're mad. The trouble is they cannot control it. They can't help it. If they get hurt, they can't stop and say, oh, what is it? They are just hair triggers away from always expressing their dissatisfaction. So they could be nasty. They could be loving, but they can be very nasty as well. Aggressive, aggressive people are sharp people that people are afraid of, and people are afraid of them. Now, whenever you see one of these people offending people, you can be sure somewhere behind them is a relationship that they have with someone else who is very sweet. It's a very common combination. The sweet person, the very nice person, they're so sweet, I can't see what she's doing with him, and the aggressive guy who's a loudmouth. Why do these couples get together? Why is there this so common? Well, what a nice person. What does she see in him? He is so brutish. He is so rough. He is so street-like in so many ways, and vice versa. Oh, what a wonderful man. He's such a sweet man, but his wife, oh, she is so bad. She's rotten. She's so nasty. What does he see in her? So we now have this combination of forces. We have the nice person with the aggressive person. Well, there's something about niceness that you should know, that every time that there is an expression of aggression by someone who tends to be a nasty, out front kind of person, behind it is usually this nice person who has a way of egging them on. Now, the niceness is called passive aggressive. You show me a nice person who is known by everybody as being sweet, angelic, they have the greatest smile, and I will show you a passive-aggressive person. Passive-aggressive. When someone hits you or yells at you, you know you've been abused. It's obvious, and it's easily identified. But the passive-aggressive is kind of covert. It's subtle. It's veiled. It's disguised. If you think of the proverb, actions speak louder than words, when it comes to the passive-aggressive and how ambiguous they could be, they rarely mean what they say or say what they mean. They're sweet. And they're always being sweet, and they're always being nice. However, they have their ways of expressing their aggression. One way is by forgetting. They forget. They get convenient. There's no easy way to punish someone than forgetting that lunch date due on their birthday, or better yet, forgetting their anniversary, or they show up late. Lateness is a passive-aggressive behavior. Passive-aggressive people are never responsible for their actions. If you aren't to blame, then something else happened at work, the traffic on the way, oh, the train was slow, or a slow clerk at the convenience store. The passive-aggressive has no faults. It's everyone around him or her who has faults, and they must be punished for those faults. They may never express anger, but there are some who are happy with whatever you say. On the outside, anyways, they're always happy to have someone else expressing their anger for them. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind with Julian Joiello. We're here talking about a thing that we see very frequently, which is the passive-aggressive person and the aggressive person. Because somehow I think politically what we're seeing is some of that being acted out in the world. I mean, if anything, you know, you could look at people who are passive-aggressive. They seem nice. They seem sweet. They seem wonderful. You would never blame them for anything. I mean, have you ever seen our president looking mean? Never looked mean, except when he killed that one fly, right? Mean? No. But think about Christie in New Jersey, right? There's an aggressive guy. He's aggressive. He's clearly you see it. So when you have somebody who's not mean, and they have this kind of passive way of being in the world, how do they express their anger? What do? They usually go through aggressive people. So to talk back about the passive aggressiveness, passive aggressive people often, they're unsure of their autonomy and they're afraid of being alone. So they fight their dependency needs by trying to control the other person. And if they have an aggressive person, they control them. It's like somebody riding a wild horse. They want you to think that they don't depend on you, but they bind themselves closer than they care to admit. Relationships become battlegrounds. The passive-aggressive person does not trust anyone. Because of this, they guard themselves against becoming intimately attached to someone. Do you want something from your passive-aggressive spouse? If so, get ready to wait for it, or maybe never get it. It is important that you don't get your way. They will forget things. They will procrastinate. They will do their way of finding a balance. Now, so here we have our choices. We have the passive-aggressive way of being, and we have the aggressive way of being. Let's think about an aggressive spectrum. You go from either being somebody who is strong and forthcoming and forthright, and then they become a little more aggressive. They're a little pushy. And then they become, you know, going up this continuum. It could either be more and more, and you could get to the point where that aggressive person becomes warlike, and they could even become psychopathic. What does psychopathic mean? Psychopathic specifically means they are aggressive without regard for the consequences of their behaviors because, for two reasons. Number one, they don't learn from their mistakes. And number two, they have no shame and no guilt. Now, you have a person like this. Let's say you have somebody who is a street fighter, who's someone like we interviewed, Henry Morales, you know, who is somebody who said, you know, he actually held up people at stores, he actually shot people. That's an aggressive person. Now, this is somebody who is very likely and very often you find people like this in the prisons. An unusual thing happens in the prisons. Somehow, people write letters to people who are prisoners, and they form relationships, and those people are usually very sweet people. Now, by sweet, I mean they're very nice, they're very kind, and they form relationships by letter with the people who are in the prison serving time for having done aggressive acts. So here's the perfect combination now, the perfect combination of the prison relationship with the letter writer, and the letter writer usually winds up sending money or giving gifts or taking care of the person who was a prisoner. But it's almost like the attraction by the nice person is to the person who is so heavy-handed. It's like a hired gun. If you don't feel you have any power in life, get related to somebody who has a lot of power. And by power, that means aggressiveness. They are likely to hit you, slap you, shoot you, do whatever. Get a relationship with somebody who is aggressive. So the passive-aggressive, the person who is afraid of their own anger, usually gets the person who is very angry to act out their anger for them. And it could be done very easily, for example. I know one woman who was at a party, and she told her husband, boyfriend actually, who was an aggressive-aggressive, and she said to him, you know, that man, he flirted with me and he insulted me, and therefore the aggressive-aggressive guy went out and started a fight with the other guy. She didn't, oh, please don't make any trouble, oh, please don't, oh, I didn't want that. She was just the innocent in the whole thing, but she was able to get even. So what we want to look for whenever we look for aggression is not specifically for the aggression itself and the person doing the aggression. Look behind it. Like we think about our previous president, everybody would see our previous president as the aggressor. No, no, no. Take one step behind that. Go to the vice president. You want to see where the real aggression was? The person in the shadows is very often calling the shot. When it comes to determining who is calling the shot, who is the one who is being the real aggressor, it's very hard for me to see because I know there's somebody behind who is doing the influence as well. So this question about taking a look at an aggressor and then targeting the aggressor, it's clearly a mistake. You can talk to me. We can now look at, should this be about whether we should bomb Syria or not bomb Syria, whether we should do retaliation? I mean, we're looking at all the wrong people. I know we're looking at the wrong people because we're supposed to be blinded by the aggression itself. And I'm not saying what's right and what's wrong. I am a pacifist. I do not believe aggression should be met with aggression. I don't believe so. There must be an exception. If somebody came to hurt someone I loved, and aggression was the only way I could respond, my aggression would meet their aggression. I won't let anybody hurt someone I care about. But in general, I do not go there thinking that aggression is the answer. Now, the passive-aggressive person is somebody who believes that aggression is the answer, and they want to get somebody else to do it for them. That's why you all feel so confused and betrayed. Let's talk about betrayal for a moment. Part of what is about the biggest pain that people are dealing with today is they feel betrayed. They feel betrayed by a president that they elected, that they believed was a true pacifist, and now they are saying all of the different things, voting for the tobacco company, voting for all these things, have led to a disheartened feeling about the person you nominate. I mean, you thought you had something different, and you're heartbroken. So many people are heartbroken by this. Well, betrayal usually comes about as a result of having some kind of hopes and ideas, making stuff up, expectations. We had expectations. We believed that it would be different. We wanted to see it differently, and we're looking at it, and it just doesn't feel different. And so, therefore, it's really us, our hopes, our expectations, that are being shattered. If you didn't have hopes and expectations, if you were someone who said, they look very good, but, you know, they are politicians, But politicians can't tell the truth. Of course they can't tell the truth, because they're passive-aggressive. And if they are all passive-aggressive, therefore, they can't tell the truth. They can't show their aggression, as we've seen. You know, but it does kind of leak out. Sometimes it leaks out sexually. We see the sexual acting out of some of the politicians, and you wonder, how could they be doing so weird sexually? Because it leaks out. Their aggression is there. So betrayal is something that we feel, and it could easily lead to a depression when we have our hopes up there. So this is a very unusual time for us in this society and in life. It's an unusual time because we, as people, are looking at something that is just so totally confusing. Let's talk about anger. What is anger? Anger itself is a reaction. You know, you could talk about a feeling of anger. Anger is something you feel. If somebody steps on your toe and you say, ouch, and you say, oh, you stepped on my toe, and then they step on your toe again, you say, hey, why'd you step on my toe? And you get angry. Anger is a reaction to being hurt, usually, or being perceived as hurt. You perceive yourself as hurt if somebody insults you or looks at you the wrong way. You can get angry because it's your reaction. The first feeling, there's usually a feeling behind anger. Now, why is it important, therefore, to express anger? Why is it, what's the big deal? Why do we spend so much time saying mentally healthy people express their anger? Well, being powerless, having something hurt you and then being powerless, seems to be the combination that leads to depression. So depression is always some form of anger felt outward that gets turned against the self. And the key ingredient here is powerlessness. So let me go over that with you. You get angry because somebody hurt you, and you express your anger. You feel the anger, and you could express it. You could say to someone, I'm angry with you for doing that to me. Why would that be such a big deal? If you're a couple and you are two people who love each other, there's a basic, it's basically simple. You almost never get angry. You remember having a roommate, you know, or a best friend of the same sex? You have a best friend of the same sex. Can you ever remember getting angry at them? Almost never. Because there's a bottom line, which is a trust. I trust that you care about me. I trust that I care about you. Am I going to get angry at you? No, I'm not going to get angry at you, but I'll tell you when I don't like something. Hey, I didn't like that so much when you showed up in the middle of the night and made so much noise and woke me up when I had to go to school the next day or something like that. You express that. But it's because there's a basic trust underneath it. However, when people stop trusting each other, then anger becomes a very important ingredient in trying to establish boundaries and borders. So if you have a family, for example, that does stuff that hurts you, it's important for you to let them know what you did hurt me, but not to just sit there and take it over and over again and smile and placate and do stuff like that. So why is anger for the mentally healthy? The people who do not express anger either express it passive-aggressively or they express it through depression. Now, the passive-aggressive expression of anger makes you turn the anger passively, and it makes you do things that make you inadequate. You show up late for things, as we said. You wind up being indecisive. It becomes a very difficult way of being. But everybody likes you. Everybody thinks you're sweet. You just can't function. So that's one way. So you show me a very sweet person, and I'm going to show you a very angry person. I deal with that. Okay, so now we have the angry person there. Or if they don't do it through passive-aggressive, they can become depressed. And very often the passive-aggressive becomes depressed. Depression is when you turn the anger against yourself. So I guess it would make more sense than anything to be able to express the anger you feel. Even though if you're someone like me, I already know by the time I feel the anger that the anger is not real, that I'm really feeling something else. Well, it's very difficult because you can't just talk yourself out of the anger you feel, which is easy to do. You talk yourself out of it by telling yourself, I shouldn't be angry. I should be greater than being angry. Huh. Very difficult, very difficult. So this whole idea of passive aggressive and aggression relating to anger is a very difficult concept, my friends, and it's a very difficult concept to get your head around. And nowadays, many of you are feeling this kind of aggressive feeling towards the people who are rendering you powerless. You're trying your very best, and it's very difficult, so you need to just understand. One thing about confronting the passive-aggressive, if you have a passive-aggressive person in your life and you want to confront them, you have to be very careful because, beware, if you confront the passive-aggressive, they're most likely going to sulk or completely walk away, leaving you standing there to deal with the problem alone. There are two reasons to confront somebody who is passive-aggressive. One is done correctly. If done correctly, you may be able to help him or her gain insight into the negative consequences of their behaviors. See, a passive-aggressive person doesn't even know how they're affecting everybody around them. But you could blame them. You know, if you blame them and you say, ah, you're late and that destroyed our thing, it doesn't work. So somehow you want to be able to confront them without blaming. Two, even if that doesn't happen, it will at least give you the opportunity to talk to someone in a frank way about how their behavior affects you. If nothing else, you get it off your chest and you don't get depressed. Here are some constructive ways to confront someone with passive-aggressive behavior. Number one, you make your feelings the subject of the conversation and not his or her bad feelings. You talk about your feelings, not their behaviors. Number two, you don't attack their character. You don't say you are always like that. You leave that alone. Number three, and very important, make sure this is done in privacy. Because if you have somebody else around, the humility of it will make that person respond differently. Number four, confront them with one behavior at a time. Don't bring everything up at once. Don't say you're always late, you're never completing things, and it's one item at a time. Number five, if they need to retreat from the conversation, allow them to do it with dignity. Allow them to back out for a short period of time. So if they can't take it for the moment, you know, if they're saying one way or another they have to escape, allow that to happen. Next, have a time limit. See, a confrontation should not last on indefinitely. In fact, I think all conversations should have a limit of 20 minutes. If you're not getting better within 20 minutes, if you haven't improved, if you don't feel better now than you did 20 minutes ago, this conversation should be stopped. Any conversation, whether it be a telephone conversation, a business conversation, it should improve. 20 minutes is the maximum amount of time that you can allow something to stay the same. Certainly not allow it to get worse. If your conversation is getting worse during the entire 20 minutes, get out of there because it's not working. Number eight, if they turn the table on you, don't react to it because it very often happens. Don't defend your need to have an adult conversation about your feelings when you could feel the table being turned on you like it's your fault. Just assume that that's part of it. Assume it's part of it. Don't react too strongly. It's one of the common tools. And lastly, be sure that they understand that you care about what happens to them, that you love them, and that you're not trying to control them. You're only trying to get to the bottom of your disagreements to make the relationship better. Love is a wonderful feeling. Loving someone and being with someone is a wonderful thing. Having a love relationship based on trust and the fact that you know this person has your best interest at heart is a beautiful thing. In that, almost any conversation can take place. Almost anything can be challenged, and almost anything can help you grow. If, however, you're in a place in life where you are just stuck, not being able to express yourself, not being able to feel what you feel safely, then it's time to move away. Okay, keep in mind, finally, that with most people who are passive-aggressive, almost nothing is real. It's like living in a dollhouse. Because the way that they feel towards you, they must manipulate you at every turn. Since they're not able to tell you exactly what they want, they have to use their words and their wiles to kind of get you to respond the way they want you to respond. So it's always an action. It's always you're being done in some way or another. You don't know it. When you're with somebody who is very sweet and very nice and who is always kind, somehow you're always being operated on, you know? It's always a bit of an operation until the time comes when they allow themselves to express their anger and show their anger directly, which is very powerful. So the one thing that they all have in common, the one thing that the passive-aggressive and the aggressive-aggressive have in common is control. See, the whole idea is to control emotions, control feelings, control things as they're happening. And the idea of not expressing your emotions when you feel them and not telling people what your boundaries are is to control them. I didn't want you to feel. That very expression, did you ever hear that expression? Person says to another person, I didn't want them to feel angry. I didn't want them to feel sad. I didn't want them, as if you have the right to control another person's feelings. Well, you do. I mean, you do control their feelings. I didn't tell the truth because I didn't want to make him angry. Means I wanted to control his ability to respond. So I would not tell him the truth because I wanted to control him. And the other way, the person who expresses anger directly, what they're doing is they are saying, I want to control you. I want to stop you from doing what you're doing, and that's why I use my aggression. Both people are trying to control the emotional outcome. Neither one likes the feeling of the other person. For as long as you're trying to control someone else's emotions, you're going to have that kind of a difficulty. It's always going to be difficult to control the other person's feelings. So you may, in your own way, be gentle, sidestep, try to make a communication that doesn't take a person over the edge. But truth is truth. And the only way that a relationship ever gets to a true loving place is when the people are not trying to control each other, but really just trying to be together as they are. And by the way, friends, WBAI, of course, needs your help, and you know what this radio is. It's unlike commercial radio. We have no rich corporations for sponsors. We need your help, and we could use your help by you making a donation. You could make a direct donation by going to WBAI.org, or you can become a WBAI buddy. I'm a buddy. I have donated. I give money every month. Taken from my credit card, which is, I'm happy to do. It's so wonderful to look down at my credit card charges and at the bottom to always see WBAI every month and know that I'm supporting it. So you can go to WBAI.org and make your donation. You could also make it in the name of any particular show. And if you like The Positive Mind, show your endorsement. Well, that's a lot of stuff to consider, huh, my friends? We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with you in just a short while. magic is not easy. No, magic is not easy. Not presto, change-o, hocus-pocus, snap your fingers and all is changed. Nothing changes. Nothing. Magic is not easy. Nothing moves unless the heart is in it, unless the will is in it. Listen. Listen, my friends. Everything is connected. Everything. Ignore that it will not compute. Everything is connected. So if you would do magic, listen. Start here. Nothing moves unless the heart is in it, unless the will is in it. Magic is not easy. Simple words won't do it. Chanting the same song day in and day out, every full or new moon is not enough. If you would speak magic, listen. Magic is fed by the heart, made manifest by the will. When the demons inside, the one whose true names are self-doubt and self-hate, have grown sufficiently strong, when we will not, cannot touch our own demons, then we invent others. Or worse, we sing the name of demons invented for us and we depend on them for magic. No, magic is not easy. If you would live magic, listen. You must move beyond your pain. You must turn and face your fear. You must touch those demons, hold them, ignore your scorching flesh because it's an illusion. Cradle the flailing thing. Cradle your own demon self until you can love it into healing. Only then can you do magic, and magic is not easy. And this is Armando Mill back with you with Julian Joiello. We're here with A Positive Mind. So we've had this discussion about anger, aggression, and passive aggression. And now we're going to talk a little bit about fear, because 9/11 is today. This is September 11th. And on September 11th, we have a lot of people who have reactions of fear. In order to, one of the questions we received recently was in our email. Now, we've been soliciting questions from the listeners that they would like to have answered. I've been trying to write back the answers, but there are just too many. So we're going to select certain questions and answer them on air on a regular basis. We will dedicate some portion of each week's programs to answering emails specifically. So we have one right now, and it relates to today being 9/11. Julian.
And this is from Leslie from Brooklyn. Armand, every time I hear there's a danger of us being under attack, like 9/11, I don't know how to deal with my fear. I'm frightened all day long. Now I'm afraid of a chemical weapon being used in New York. People tell me that I shouldn't be so afraid, but I can't help the reaction I feel inside. I have trouble sleeping. I'm nervous, and I'm always expecting the worst. What can I do?
So keep in mind what fear is and what that kind of nervousness is about. We're going to talk about that on three different levels. The first level is, let's talk about it physiologically. We have a little center of our brain called the amygdala. It's a tiny little part of our brain. But this part of our brain is the part that makes us feel the most nervous. It's the most energy. When you have your amygdala firing, which means it has a lot of activity, it automatically senses there is danger. So if you have a sensation inside of you of being nervous, your body is automatically looking for where's the danger. Now, certain people are going to be, are engineered to be searching for the danger somewhere in the neighborhood. You look and you say, I am frightened. Since I am frightened, I wonder what I'm frightened of, and you make up the thing you're afraid of. There are certain people who seem to be born or engineered to be protectors of the tribe. A protector of the tribe is someone who gets nervous for everyone else. If I have you worrying about everything, then I don't have to worry. If you're, imagine back then when man was barely standing on his own two feet yet, where there would be one group of people who would be hunters, another group would be painting in the caves. And then there would be these other people on the periphery who were looking for danger. Is there another tribe going to attack? Are there animals that are going to attack us? Somebody carries more nervousness than everybody else in any community, in any tribe. You may be that person, Leslie. You may be one of those nervous types, like the Woody Allen type of nervousness. In the Enneagram, which is something I refer to a lot, this is called the number 6 personality. And according to the Enneagram, that's 1/9 of the population. People who are frightened are serving the rest of the people by putting out cautions, by laying out cautions there that many of the rest of us don't feel. What good is that for you? I mean, how does that help you sleep? What can you do about it? Well, understanding that you have a propensity for this kind of fear, that you have a tendency to be this afraid, is very important. Because now you can say, okay, this is part of my job. I get worried for everybody because I'm genetically engineered to get worried for everybody. But then there's a second part of it. There is people who are frightened types who are afraid of retribution. One of the questions you would ask yourself is, if I were attacked, for what would I be punished? Many people are waiting to be punished. And what are they waiting to be punished for? Some crime that they committed as a child or as an adult that they think that they feel guilty about, and they don't feel, they're just waiting to get punished for it. So there is this retributive fear, a fear that somehow you're going to be punished for something that you did when you were younger. Identifying that fear, talking about that fear, could be as little as treating your sister badly. It could be as little as feeling that in some way you had a special relationship with your mother away from your father, that you triangulated, that you caused trouble. People who live with those kind of retribution fears very often get triggered, so you have to worry, what is she afraid of being punished for? So one of the second is the psychological. The psychological is being the fear of being punished. The first is the fear that you feel because it's just kind of you're chemically built to be that frightened. What's good about it? What could you do about it? Well, if you speak to someone about it, and if you talk to someone, you try to get to the basis of it. And I've never met anyone who has been a very, very frightened type who has not eventually gotten over that fear by being able to talk about it, by being able to find somebody who doesn't judge them. Now, one thing we know for sure, that if you know someone who is that frightened, you can be there for them without judging them. You can sympathize with them. You can understand. You don't have to argue the point. Arguing whether you're right or wrong for being afraid, that doesn't work. Thank you, Leslie. I hope that's useful. If you have more questions, please feel free to write into us. Our next question relates to something that we're also dealing with today.
This is from Gary from Manhattan. Armand, I recently lost my brother. He was born with muscular dystrophy and suffered his whole life. Throughout this childhood, he was in pain. He suffered every minute of his life, yet he somehow maintained a positive attitude. Now that he's passed away, I am suffering. I suffer the grief of the loss of my brother. How can I end this endless cycle?
Gary, what you may be dealing with is called survivor's guilt. Survivor's guilt is when somebody, it happens frequently when there are auto accidents or things like that, where one person lives and the other people don't. It's almost like it's your duty to continue this. The other thing that may be at force here is that there may be the illness itself may have been a focus of the family pain. Very often, when there is a whole family who is focused around the illness of one person, when that person dies, somebody else picks up the illness so that the family can continue to focus on this other person. This helps them not focus on themselves. But it does bring up a very big question about suffering itself. And so I would like to talk a bit about this. There was an article in the New York Times that I found really fascinating, which called The Value of Suffering. Hundreds of Syrians are apparently killed by chemical weapons, and the attempt to protect others from the fate threatens to kill many more. A child perishes with her mother in a tornado in Oklahoma, the month after an 8-year-old son is slain by a bomb in Boston. Runaway trains claim dozens of lives in otherwise placid Canada and Spain. At least 46 people are killed in a string of coordinated bombings aimed at ice cream shops, bus stations, and a famous restaurant in Baghdad. Does the torrent of suffering ever abate? And can one possibly find any point in this suffering? Wise men in every tradition tell us that suffering brings clarity, illumination, For the Buddha, suffering is the first rule of life. And insofar as some of it arises from our own wrong-headedness, our cherishing of self, we have the cure for it within us. Thus, in certain cases, suffering may be an effect as well as the cause of taking ourselves too seriously. I once met a Zen-trained painter in Japan in his 90s who told me that suffering is a privilege. It moves us towards thinking about essential things and shakes us out of short-sighted complacency. When he was a boy, he said, it was believed that you should pay for suffering. It proves such a hidden blessing. None of that applies to a child gassed to death, or born with AIDS, or hit by a limited strike. Philosophy cannot cure a toothache, and the person who starts going on about its long-term benefits may induce a headache, too. Anyone who's been too close to a loved one suffering from depression knows that the vicious cycle behind her condition means that, by definition, she can't hear the logic or reassurances we extend to her. If she could, she wouldn't be suffering from depression. So what's that suffering about? Is it that suffering can be in the eye of the beholder, our ignorant projection? The quadriplegic asks you not to extend sympathy to her. She's happy, even if her form of pain is more visible than yours. The man on the street in Calcutta, India, or Port-au-Prince, Haiti, overturns all our simple notions about the relation of terrible conditions to cheerfulness and energy, and asks why we haven't just brought our ideas of poverty with us. But does that change all the many times when suffering leaves us with no seeming benefit at all, and only a resentment of those who tell us to look on the bright side and count our blessings, and recall that time heals all wounds, when we know it doesn't? None of us expect life to be easy. To live, as Nietzsche and Roberta Flack had it, is to suffer. To survive is to make sense of suffering. That's why survival is not guaranteed. So a question here is about the value of suffering, and this is as you think about it. In the religions, they've always kind of pointed to suffering as part of God's way. And so, because you had to make sense out of it, you know, if you're going to be a good Catholic, how come your child is stricken with disease? And it's something about God's way, and it's something about suffering. So in order to keep a religion going, they take suffering, and they make suffering to be something that's glorified. I don't know what the sense of suffering is. I know suffering has a lot to do with how we perceive it. Because you could be suffering over a romance that has no meaning whatsoever, or you could be suffering over something that is truly tragic, like the loss of a child. Somehow the suffering effect seems to be cleansing. That as you suffer, as you go through it, you get somewhat cleansed, you get somewhat freed. It lessens your burden. So I'm not sure about the meaning of suffering. I do know that there's one way to avoid it, which is to close yourself down and shut down your heart in every way possible. And I know there's another way to feel it and to let yourself go through it. And then I know there's a third way, which is to stay mired in it forever. My path is to go through it. I really believe that you can go through it and release yourself through the other side. I hope that's helpful. Let's move on to another question.
This one is from Tyrone from the Bronx. Armand, I'm a rule breaker. I can never hold a job. Every time I try to hold a job, I find that there's one rule or another that I have to challenge. Now I'm planning to get married, and I'm afraid that my oppositional, rebellious nature is going to stop me from being able to enjoy the inherent potential beauty of my marriage. I want a family, desperately. But I am so afraid of myself and how I challenge every structure. What do you advise?
Well, Tyrone, you know, you're so far along this path, it's really beautiful. The fact that you could observe yourself at that level, the fact that you know about your oppositional nature, the fact that you could see yourself and ask these questions about yourself makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it's whoever you're with has got a gift because you have so much personal insight. So let's break it down a little bit. not being able to keep a job and being able to always fighting structures, that probably has more to do with your feelings towards your father. Usually when people have difficult relationships with their fathers, they have difficulties with all authorities. This will be with the police. This will be with jobs and all other kind of structures. And usually it comes out in that form. As you begin to understand that this person is not an authority who's trying to hurt you in some way, you'll get over that. But that does not necessarily connect to your relationship with your potential wife that you're talking about. If I believe that if you're going to have a love relationship with the kind of awareness that you have, a whole different world opens up to you, which could be totally different. You may lose all of this oppositional nature once you feel the feeling of family. It seems that all through your life, what you've done is survive trying to find a peaceful family. And in this case, here you are about to start your own family or find your marriage. Everything might just disappear. Not that the marriage will be the answer, but it's your insight, your personal insight, the personal awareness that you have combined with probably this beautiful love that you talk about. I think those two could do wonders for you. So, in my opinion, it's worth the risk. Keep your eyes open. Keep your heart open. And if you would, Julian, let's take another letter.
Okay, this one is from Gina from Hoboken. Armand, I am so very lonely. I have many people around me, family and friends, but there is no one who gets who I really am. I feel like I don't connect with most people. What can I do to start letting people in?
You know, Gina, there are just some people who feel like they're alienated from the rest of the world, and they feel like they're on one planet and everybody else is on another planet completely. That's just a way of being. Now, how do you get to let people in if you feel so isolated from people? Well, unfortunately, it starts with one. It starts off small and then it gets bigger. I strongly recommend seeing a counselor, seeing a therapist, and learning to find somebody who you can trust. The therapeutic relationship, the relationship between a therapist and a client, is almost exclusively about trust. You learn sometime early in life that you can't trust anybody. That's early, and then so you keep everybody closed out. And then you find a therapist. What the therapist does is not just help you look in your past and figure out your past, but they help prove to you that somebody is trustworthy. Now, in order to do that, you have to find a therapist who is trustworthy. That means they have to really be there with their heart. They have to really, really be committed to you. But once you get it, once you find a therapist who is willing to see you, who is willing to work with you, who is willing to be there for you, who does not judge you, it opens the door. It takes a little door inside of you that has previously been closed saying, watch out, everybody's dangerous, and you let one person in. Then maybe from that you let another person in, or maybe you have a group therapy and you let more people in. This is the ideal case for recommending psychotherapy or counseling. So again, of course, if you had somebody that was simple, if you had a bartender, or if you had a cab driver, or you had somebody who you work with who you could trust, that would be one thing, but you wouldn't be writing this letter. The ache that you're feeling is one that I'm very, very familiar with. And it's an ache to be heard. It's an ache to be seen, to be truly seen. And once that's resolved, once you feel it, once you say, hey, there's somebody who really knows me, the door opens. It's not that just to that person, but the door itself, which has been so closed, opens again, and you begin to let people in your life. So you have a good fortune. You sound young enough to be able to go anywhere in the future. I am sure you'll eventually get there. If you need a recommendation for someone, let me know. I'll find somebody just where you live. We're going to be able to take one more question right now, and this is one that I've received many times in many different forms. Go ahead, Julian.
This is from Angela from Staten Island. Armand, I recently caught my husband having a romantic relationship with somebody after I saw their text messages on his iPhone. He admitted that he has been having a relationship with someone, and we are considering our options. We have a family with four young children. Is it possible to heal a marriage after this kind of break in trust?
You see, now that's one of the big questions that we have, my friends. Here's the amazing piece of it, okay? When a trust is broken between anyone, between two friends or in a relationship, in a marriage, wherever it is, when a trust is broken, it indicates that there was something wrong that you two weren't talking about. There was something he wasn't getting and something you weren't getting in this relationship, but somehow keeping a marriage together, keeping it together for the children, has led to a certain amount of need on his part to move outside of the relationship. So here comes the question. The one question is, will he continue in that other relationship? And that means you have to make a decision around that. I've known people who have tried to do that. I haven't seen anybody succeed at it. Being able to stay married and have a relationship with someone else at the same time, I haven't seen that work if everybody's aware of it. Usually that only happens, well, when there is secrecy. Do you want there to be secrecy? Do you want it to be covered? The people who get through this relationship, the people who get through of an incident like this, have the most amazing relationships later. So here's the deal. The deal is, if you do try to heal it, and you can, and if you're able to do it, you have something so much better because it's been challenged and it's been healed. So my statement to you is, definitely the two of you should seek out some kind of counseling before you do anything and try to talk it over. It may or may not be possible. You may not be able to get the images out of your mind. He may not be able to allow himself to get past this, if possible. You know, the children are at risk one way or another, but even though you feel that the children are at risk if you break up your relationship, the children already knew on some level that this was going on. They knew it even before you knew it, Angela. You know, they unconsciously knew it the whole time. They knew Daddy wasn't always at home, and there was something else. So the answer to your question is, I've seen this kind of relationship heal and get much better after time, or maybe it's time to separate. Either one, I believe a counselor is a good idea, and to talk it over. But don't give up the ghost. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We won't have time to take any more of your calls today. We've been taking them primarily from the emails. We have about 400 here, and we've selected four. But we'll try to put them in bunches and put them together, and we'll every week, hopefully every second half of Wednesdays, we will answer calls. So be sure to send me an email, armand@thepositivemind.com. Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, @thepositivemind.com. We'll gather your letters, or you could actually address it through Facebook as well, I guess. No, I guess that's more difficult, Julian says. So he's made a face, you know. He didn't say it out loud, but he made a face.
I've got that Facebook message face.
That was a silent no Facebook message face. Anyway, do feel free to contact us, armand@thepositivemind.com, and we'll be back with you. We'll answer some of your questions. Originally, this program was meant to do that directly, and our current location at WBAI, the way we're streaming now, we can't take your calls, but we will very shortly, as soon as they get Brooklyn in order. Brooklyn is the new home for WBAI. We'll be back with you next Tuesday, my friends, at 1 p.m. This is Armand DeMille with Julian Joiello. Back with you soon.